This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
DirecTV Stream has the most local MLB games, which means it's never been easier to
root for the home team.
So whether you're rooting for a aura,
safe,
or even a
strike three,
or a
it's out of here,
root for your home team with DirecTV Stream, the most MLB games, period. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. This is Dr. Melek Fırat Altay. I am a musician and a neuroscientist. My research focuses on deciphering the pathomechanisms of neurodegenerative and neurodevelopmental disorders, and today I will be your host. We will be talking to Larry Sherman and Dennis Plies about their new book, Every Brain Needs Music, The Neuroscience of Making and Listening to Music, published by the Columbia University Press this year. Larry Sherman, a neuroscientist and lifelong musician, and Dennis Plies, a professional musician and teacher, collaborate to show how our brains and music work in harmony. They consider music in all the ways we encounter it: teaching, learning, practicing, listening, composing, improvising, and performing, in terms of neuroscience as well as music pedagogy, showing how the brain functions and even changes in the process. Every Brain Needs Music draws on leading behavioral, cellular, and molecular neuroscience research, as well as surveys of more than 100 musical people. It provides new perspectives on learning to play, teaching, how to practice and perform, the ways we react to music, and why the brain benefits from musical experiences. Larry and Dennis, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining me today for this interview. I'm really excited. How are you? How's life?
I'm doing fine. This is Dennis.
Yeah, it's great to be here. This is Larry. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, I'm really excited because this book is really covering the two areas that are real fields of passion for me, music and neuroscience. So before we get to discuss the book, could you maybe start by telling us a little bit about yourselves? Larry, let's start with you first.
Well, sure. So my name is Larry Sherman. I'm a professor of neuroscience at the Oregon Health and Science University. I'm also the president of the Society for Neuroscience for the state of Oregon in the United States and Southwest Washington. And my research in my day job, if you will, is trying to figure out how to fix damaged brains in people with multiple sclerosis and Alzheimer's and other neurological diseases. But I've also been a lifelong musician and have a fascination with music. And I've been giving talks about music and the brain now for over 15 years.
And Dennis?
Yes. Well, my background is that I was enamored with music at a very early age. Age three, my parents share that I would sit and listen to the classical station for an hour and still, very still, and taking it in, and begged for piano lessons. They finally found one. At age six, but it was not piano, it was the marimba. And because it's the same keyboard standing up and playing it, but I would learn the basics of music and reading, and that took me, interestingly enough, onto television by age 7, as I really took to music, and then I added piano when I was 8, and added trumpet when I was 10, and took these lessons all my years. And then when I went to college, I realized that I could study pipe organ. And so eventually I got a 2 degrees in percussion at American Conservatory of Music in Chicago. And eventually my interest went to teaching. So pedagogy is a very meaningful word to me in the art of teaching. And that led to a dissertation on how to teach improvisation, because at age 28, I was asked a hard question in Chicago by my professor. He says, "You talk a lot about jazz, you love jazz, but do you want to do it?" And I said, yes. And that changed my life. Because I had spent 2 years as a business administration major in college, just because test results show that would be being an accountant would be what your brain is about. And those tests back then did not reveal artistic sensitivities and such.
Wow, amazing. And but how did you two meet each other, and how did you come to write Every Brain Needs Music?
Well, it turns out that I mentioned that I've been giving these talks. So I had been playing piano at an event for my department at my university. And somebody overheard me and says, "I didn't know you played piano." And I said, "Yeah, I've been in bands my whole life and playing music my whole life." And this person, her name was Bobby Haggerty, asked me if I would give a talk about music in the brain to a group that she sponsored every year. And so I said, that'd be fun. So I kind of put something together with a little bit of humor, and I actually added music, live music. I could play the piano and lecture from the piano and put some fun visuals into it. And I found out all these connections between the things that I do in my lab and what happens in the brain when you engage with music. And so I really got excited about it, put this talk together. That led to many more talks, because people asked me how much I would charge to give that talk. Not expecting that anybody would pay to hear something like this. And so after doing that talk probably a couple hundred times, one morning I was at our gym. And it turns out it's the same, Dennis and I go to the same gym at about this time in the morning. It's actually earlier. We're at 6 o'clock in the morning in Portland, Oregon. And I didn't know Dennis. I'd seen him around at the gym, but we were in the locker room, and I was talking to my racquetball partner about one of the talks that I'd given the night before. And Dennis says, "Did you say you gave a talk about music in the brain?" And I said, "Yeah." And he turns to me and says, "I've seen your talk twice. And I just didn't recognize you without any clothes on." And so that led to a lot of conversations. And I found out that Dennis, what he didn't just tell you was that at the time he was a professor of music at Warner Pacific University. And we had these incredible discussions about music and history and art and everything else, and creativity and teaching. And one thing led to another, and Dennis and I just decided we'd write this book together. It would be a great marriage, because I didn't want to write just a book about the neuroscience of music. There's a lot of great books out there on that topic. And I thought if we had something that combined the neuroscience with the pedagogy and the musical experience, that would be a kind of a novel approach to talking about this subject.
Right. So let's talk about music. And I have a very basic and a very difficult question at the same time. So what is your definition of music? And does it have a purpose or a function?
Dennis, you want to start with yours?
The one I appreciate is rather simple, and that it's organized sound and silence. And in the jazz realm, I was taught a wonderful pedagogue, Jerry Gray, that you play your ideas, but they are framed by silence, and it's like looking at a picture on the wall. The frame is part of the picture, and so sound and silence organized. That'd be mine.
Yeah, and I love that definition. But as a scientist, I think there's a great quote from Frank Zappa, who said that a composer is a guy who goes around forcing his will on unsuspecting air molecules, often with the assistance of unsuspecting musicians. And from the standpoint of both physics and neuroscience, when you think about what sound is, it's vibrating air molecules floating through space, going into the ear and being picked up by the machinery of the ear, the inner ear, and then being transported to the auditory cortex in the brain, and then sent on to other parts of the brain where it becomes perceived as music. So it's a rather not quite so poetic way to think about music as organized sound, but it kind of captures really all of the aspects of it. As to the purpose of music, I think, you know, this incredible thing that we spend so much of our time creating and listening to and engaging with has many purposes, but I think probably the one that, if you think in evolutionary terms, probably makes the most sense is that it actually brings people together. There's all this great data about how singing together or playing instruments together actually changes neurochemistry in a way that makes people feel more accepted within groups. And then, of course, the other powerful thing about music is it's an incredible way to transmit information. If you put lyrics to music, it's much more compelling in many ways than it is with just the lyrics alone. And in fact, people's brains really react to that. If you haven't sung a song in many years and you start humming the tune, the lyrics come back to you. So as an information transmitting system, I think it's been used over the years in very different ways, in a very powerful way, to bring people together and to tell stories and to bring information to people.
So there are many aspects to music making. We could listen to music, we could improvise, or we could compose. So on the neuroscience side, how does the brain handle these different activities? So for example, do we process music differently when we practice or when we improvise or when we compose? Could you expand a little bit on this?
Yeah. So in terms of what the brain's doing, if you think about improvisation versus composing, you know, composing is a very deliberate activity. And so what's happening in the brain is you're activating centers of the brain involved in planning, involved in pattern recognition and change. All these other things are coming together and integrating. And, you know, I think Dennis can speak more to this, but, you know, when you're composing, you're doing all these different things that are meant to last. So you're going to be editing a lot. You're going to be changing things. You're going to be imagining what you want the next part of the music to sound like. In contrast with improvisation, you're kind of letting go. It's really meant to be in the moment, and it's not something that's meant to last necessarily. So remarkably, when you look at what's happening in the brain when you're improvising, is you're actually turning a lot of things off to disinhibit rules and all these other things that are maybe constraining you from letting go and trying something new. Dennis, what do you think?
Well, definitely on the composing side, it's heavy thinking, decision-making. What is the very next best note? What rhythm am I employing? What harmony? So it's all about thinking and decision making. And then improvisation is not really winging it. It is very much knowledge based. I can barely speak in English, but there's no way I can speak in a language that I'd have no vocabulary of. And so the structure of knowledge and practicing scales and chords and ideas and having what you hear in the ear become something on the instrument so that you're not just pushing buttons or flailing sticks behind a marimba. It's purposeful and it's directed by what you're hearing. But to be able to practice so much to get that connection so that what you hear, you can put onto the piano or whatever instrument takes a lot of practice.
So it's not in terms of what's happening in the brain then. I mean, you're right. I mean, you have to have the experience to play the instrument that you're playing, obviously, and to understand the music that you're hearing and working with. But in terms of what you're doing when you improvise compared to composing, you're actually turning off networks that are allowing you to like do things that are a little bit more free, I think, than you do when you're composing, which is so intentional and so planned, and involves a lot of editing. And we talk about audiation, imagining sound and then putting it to paper or putting it to the screen. And these are very different types of activities that your brain is engaging in. You asked about practicing music. Well, that's a whole different thing. So your brain's doing something very, very different when you're practicing, especially when you're learning a new instrument. And I don't know if you want to get into that now, but yeah, so that's actually where my expertise actually comes in, because sort of the big message that we have is there are three major processes we undergo when we learn to play a new instrument. One is myelination, which is what I study in my lab. And so myelin is this material that wraps around the nerve processes and allows for very high speed transmission of information, the electrical signals. So I always like to tell people, if you have myelin and you're a nerve cell, it's like you're driving on the Autobahn in Germany at midnight where there's no speed limit. You can be going 200, no one's going to stop you. And if you lose your myelin, it's like driving on a really congested highway at rush hour, where you're lucky to be going, 2 kilometers per hour, right? So that's actually about the difference in speed when you lose your myelin. And so you think about what our brains are doing when we're engaging with music in any way, there has to be very high speed communication between these different parts of our brain. And if any of that breaks down, you can't do it. Remarkably, it turns out that when we practice a new instrument and learn a new way to play music, it drives the formation of new myelin. And that's really remarkable. So that's one thing that we can benefit from, and one thing that changes in the brain when we're actually learning to play an instrument. And when we practice something intentionally and everything else, those types of things are going to be happening. Another thing that's happening is we know for sure we're making new connections between neurons, and those are called synapses. And so the synapses are connections between cells that help form these circuits in our brain. And when we learn something like playing a piano or playing a guitar, or even really intentionally learning to be a good vocalist, you're forming new synapses. And the more you practice, the stronger those synapses are. You may forget a piece and then come back to it years later. Rehearsing then re-strengthens those synapses. If you forget about it and just don't do it again, those synapses go away. But this is also happening when we engage with music that way, when we're practicing music. And then finally, when we're making new music and practicing new music, one of the things we think is happening is we're actually making new neurons. And so this is something when I was in grad school, we didn't think was possible, but it turns out there are these neural stem cells in our brains that are capable of becoming new neurons. And there's some evidence to suggest that musicians, professional musicians, are, when they're pushing themselves to learn something really new, are capable of generating new nerve cells. And so that's the process of neurogenesis. And so we have myelination, neurogenesis, and synapse formation all happening in our brains when we're learning a new instrument and then practicing it. For the more practical aspects of practicing, I have to turn to Dennis, because I think to generate those things, there's very specific things you have to do when you practice music and have this relationship with a music teacher, if you have one, that will be important to have that happen. What do you think, Dennis?
I taught 5 lessons yesterday on piano, and one of them is age 68, and piano is new to him. He's
Wow.
And it's absolutely challenging for him. And then I taught a 60-year-old woman who she's only started a few months, and she's doing it for prevention of dementia. It's in her stream, she says, and it's very purposeful. And then I taught three of our grandchildren, and their ages 10, 11, and 12, and 10, 11, and 14. And each of them, it's a matter of finding their motivation and teaching them practice techniques. I don't expect them to take all of my advice. I've taught hundreds of students, but the advice, it has to do with narrowing down the focus. It's sort of like a 3x5 card focus. One thing we can do when we practice an instrument or singing is how fast we go and how little part, a little chunk of something, so that we can be successful. That's the whole point, is to be successful rather than to rush through a piece and then clobber it and then go back to the beginning and re-clobber it. That is such a waste of time, but it is so, it's such a human tendency.
I know from personal experience, it's extremely inefficient and everyone does it.
So going slower and taking a smaller passage is very wise. And the other, there are things really break down to one of three aspects. It's either you don't understand the rhythm or not portraying it accurately, or you're misreading the notes, or you're not playing the notes that you're hearing, or it's a technical problem. And when the gesture, a physical gesture, looks like the sound of the music, now you're talking.
Wow.
Sweeten your business purchases with American Express Blue Business Cash, the card that makes everyday expenses extra rewarding. You'll earn 2% cash back on your first $50,000 in purchases per year, and then 1% after that, so you can treat your bottom line and give your business a helpful boost. Swipe after swipe. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/bluebusinesscash. Amex Blue Business Cash. Built for business by American Express.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ah, this is interesting. I never thought of this. Repeat the last comment. The physical gesture.
So that would, on a piano, let's say you have an octave leap. So when the hand is not just stretching, but it's moving to the point at which you're going to apply the weight of your particular finger, when it looks like what it sounds, that is a connection of it's definitely would apply to dancers, and it's just dancing on an instrument appropriately when it really looks like, if you're playing staccato, for example, that should have a different look than legato.
And this comes back to what I was saying about all these processes that are happening when you're learning to play an instrument, but also when you're just learning to play a piece. You know, you're thinking about what you're doing. You're combining. I mean, let's say you're reading music. Okay, so you're taking this visual information off the page or off of a screen. The photons are going into your eye. They're going to the back of your eye, to the retina, where information is first processed. That's going to be sent all the way down your optic nerve, and then eventually to the back of your brain, where visual information is first processed. And then from there, it's going to go out to all these different areas that are asking questions like, what is that note? Where is that note relative to other notes on the page? And then that information is going to be sent to other areas of your brain to understand all these other things that are part of that script that you're reading. And then finally being sent to the areas of your brain, like the thalamus, which is going to control relays to your motor cortex. All these things are happening, and then sent down your arms to finally play that note. And like Dennis says, if you're having to make your hand go from one C to the next higher C up, because maybe your hand isn't quite big enough to do an octave, that's a lot of really intense, very fine movement that has to happen. And the only way you're going to get that to happen smoothly is by practicing and practicing and practicing. But when you're doing that, you're actually, again, generating these synapses, you may be altering your myelin. All these things are happening to make that work appropriately and to get to the point where you accomplish your goal of making that sound good.
That's the beauty of learning music, I feel. You have to pay attention. You have to be thinking. And it's just a thorough brain workout.
Yeah, I mean, you're combining fine and gross motor movement, sensory information, cognitive information. You're listening to what you're playing, and so you're having to adjust your playing based on what you're hearing. So you've got visual and auditory happening. You're having an emotional response to that. So all these things are happening in your brain in less than picoseconds, which is really remarkable.
And it's definitely exciting to practice something and then hear the difference and to say, I just learned something. I have a skill that I didn't have 5 minutes ago. That in itself is a reward. It's a dopamine hit.
Yes,
I mean, absolutely. I would argue that playing a musical instrument is probably one of the most challenging things a human brain can do. I always think about these people who play these multi-tiered organs. I'm sure Dennis has done this. Your hands are all over the place. Your feet are on pedals that are moving. Maybe you're pulling out stops, and then add to that singing on top of that. Oh my gosh, your brain is an incredible workout for a brain.
Yeah.
But so is playing Mary Had a Little Lamb if you've never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or a guitar or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when you're performing in front of people, I mean, by that stage, probably you're not reading, especially if you're a classical Western musician, you're past the stage of reading off the manuscript, because you probably play from memory, but then other aspects come into play, such as reacting to the audience and reacting to the environment that you're performing in, especially if you're a pianist, because you cannot carry your own instrument. You also have to adapt to the instrument, plus you might have stage fright and anxiety, so many different things to handle all at once. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, about performing in front of people.
Well, I think from the neuroscience point of view, and I think Dennis will speak to this more, your brain has now gone from the practice mode in this kind of safe space you've been in to get everything right, to a space which you may never have been in before. The acoustics may be different. That's one thing, you know, so you're thinking, how does my instrument sound in this space? And like you said, maybe it's not your instrument, maybe it's another instrument. So you have to kind of get used to that too. Then you've got your brain. So your brain's gonna react to that and actually make small changes in how you play what you've practiced. The good news is you practiced so well that you feel comfortable with just the act of performing on the instrument of choice. But there's things you may need to change, and your brain's going to make these changes based on auditory information, visual information. If you're playing with another musician or group of musicians, again, you're going to make adjustments based on how they're performing. So there's all these things that are going to be happening. And then if you add the audience to the mix, you know, you may react to them, and your brain is going to be listening. If you think about it, it's really a group of brains in a room. So your brain is doing something with an instrument that was instructed to you by the brain of a composer, unless you're just improvising on your own. But you think about how many brains are just there, you know, the brain of the composer, the brain of the musician, who are trying to recreate something that the composer had in mind. And then there's the brains of the audience who are reacting to the music. And then that's feeding back on the brains of the musicians, the performers, because maybe they're restless. Maybe they're humming along or singing along or clapping. Maybe they're wrinkling pieces of paper, you know. And your brain is reacting to all of these things and adjusting accordingly based on that great, you know, foundation of what you did when you were practicing the piece you're performing.
So let's talk about the aesthetics of music. I mean, we might strongly like or dislike certain types of music or performances. What are the underlying reasons for this? Do we have any idea on the neuroscience side as to what makes us associate with certain types of music, enjoy listening to them?
A lot of our early preferences stem from early experiences, especially in adolescence, but also to some degree in early childhood. So it's what you're exposed to, right? So if you grow up listening to Chinese opera, you're going to have a different preference than someone who grew up listening to something from India or something from the West. You know, these music preferences, it's based on what we hear in early life. And in fact, different cultures have different scale systems even. And so that's going to affect your preference to some degree. But then, of course, you're growing up and you get to be an adolescent and your friends are listening to one type of music. And so that may impact your choice to listen to that kind of music versus some other kind of music. I still love classical rock music because that's what my friends were listening to. And that's what I was exposed to and I got into. Later in life, you may add to that or subtract from it. Actually, you may get bored with one kind of music or just not like it anymore for one or other reason. That is an adjustment that has to do with our reward systems, dopamine and everything else that's rewarding our brains in one way or the other. So we hear something and we like it. And we may like it because, again, of our previous experience. We may like it because of its novelty, right? So we may hear something and think, wow, that's so unusual. And that's a rush. And when we like something that actually involves a group of proteins called opioid receptors, and in particular, so-called mu opioid receptors, and that's a liking response. Believe it or not, a technical term, liking. And when we like something, it actually drives us to activate the reward system. When we like something, we want it. So wanting is another response, again, driven mostly by dopamine and the reward system. And then when we get what we want, that's a reward. We get happy and excited by that. And that drives us back to the liking cycle. And when you get enough of it, you feel satiated, you feel happy. This liking wanting cycle can kind of drive our preferences for music. But it also can drive you to get away from music because you like it first and then your new opioid receptors get too stimulated and they get turned off and then it's like, I don't like this anymore. I want to move on to something else. So these are things that happen throughout our lives. And again, our plasticity of our brain has a lot to do with what we like when we are in different parts of our lives. It's about the things you're exposed to early on in life. Partly, again, about social aspects, you know, what are your peers listening to? Partly about what you're exposed to later in life and how that alters those preferences, and how all that is affecting this reward system, this liking, wanting response.
Dennis, would you like to add to that?
Well, it seems like it comes down to exposure and also the power of culture that I think of nature and nurture, the eternal quandary. What do we bring genetically to the table? And then how does what our environment contribute to awakening that or dampening it? And I also think of musical tastes similar to food tastes. And part of that is exposure. And then the other is physiologically. I mean, what am I hearing? What am I tasting? What does the person next to me hear and taste? And we're individuals, and yet then we're in culture. So I have found it a fascination that my musical tastes have changed over the years. And what in my 20s and 30s, I could not get enough raucous avant-garde sounds in my ears, but it was a learning time. And now at age 81, I can barely handle the raucousness. I'm apparently mellowing down into a different stage of life, and it's almost scary. So part of it is age development too, I think, that can play into people's tastes, need for care, more less stress. Yeah, what used to not be stressful, but I begged for it in my 20s and 30s is now seemingly stressful. And
I think also maybe an aspect of finding a balance between predictability and surprise. I find this to be a very important element to make me like listening to something or not. If I can predict everything from the beginning, then I get completely bored and I never even bother listening to the rest.
Absolutely. And I think there are personality traits that can predict how you like or dislike certain types of music. Even in a bigger sense, do you prefer sad songs to happy songs, for example? A lot of people really love sad music. And think about how many songs are out there on the radio at any given moment or on, you know, various streaming services that are sad songs. Why do we seek out sad music? And it turns out it has to do with personality traits involving empathy and again, coming back to the reward system. So some people really like sad songs because they have a high level of empathy. There's some sense that sad songs are kind of cathartic, because you can experience the sadness without experiencing the event that causes you to be sad. But some people feel like, you know, you have this empathy for the person who's singing these very sad lyrics. Turns out empathy is a rewarding trait. If you feel empathy, it's a reward to you. It's a rewarding to you to feel empathetic. So there's this really interesting feedback loop about how sad songs can be liked by some people. Some people hate listening to sad songs. It really drives them to tears and they don't like that. And so they prefer happier music or at least neutral music. And so again, that has to do with a lot of personality traits that everybody's different.
Right. It's been really fascinating, this discussion. It's a really favorite subject for me to talk about the neuroscience of music or just neuroscience. So what are you currently working on? Do you have any new projects coming up?
I don't, but I'm trying to put the book into practice and challenge myself and challenge my brain for synaptic development and myelination by practicing really things that just gnarl me. I mean, I appreciate what I'm doing, but they're not fun. I might say I'm working on melodic minor scales, but when the melodic minor goes up one way and comes down another, and so now I'm learning only to go the way I went up to come down, and then to do that in all modes. And it's more of a jazz scale anyway, but in all the modes of that minor, that renewed melodic minor scale, it's a killer. It makes my brain have to think and keep attention. I'm reading music backward, so that I literally I read the rhythm as it's showing, but I'm very mindful that I'm a reader who's used to patterns forward, and so I'll catch myself playing the pattern forward that I perceived, even though I'm trying to just do one note at a time. I'll play on the piano or the vibes or marimba a melody with my left hand instead of my right hand, and then play chords with the other hand. And this is all done in different keys. And and without eyes looking at the keyboard. So I'm in a space of seeking sound wise, and there's chords in scales. So it's knowing a scale is one thing, but you can play it in thirds, and then you can stack the thirds into triads, and you can stack them on into seventh chords, and et cetera. And if you do that in all keys in various inversions, you've got a lot of work to do.
It sounds like a major challenge.
But that's a life choice, because I'm not choosing to learn another instrument right now. And
oh, which one?
Not. I'm.
He's not.
You're not. Sorry.
Yeah. So I've decided I'll work rugged material on the instruments I'm okay on.
Dennis and I were talking about this the other day at the gym, and I said to him, I said, you really need to take careful notes on this, because this is exactly the kind of thing that I think music therapists would gain from. And I think, pushing yourself on an instrument that you're familiar with might be more easy to convince a patient to do who's suffering from some sort of traumatic brain injury, for example, than learning a whole new instrument. But the challenge can still be there. And that's the amazing thing about music. You can always find ways to really challenge your brain and push yourself outside your comfort zone to do something that's going to really push those processes we mentioned before, myelination and neurogenesis and synapse formation. So,
and I believe that's true because of the simultaneity that's going on in music making. You obviously have rhythm, you obviously have melody, and there's an implied harmony, even if you're not producing it. And there's tone quality, and there's patterns galore that you can think about and practice. And so it's the simultaneity, and then your body is being used to make all of this happen. So the simultaneity.
So for my big new project, I mean, other than the constant work going on in my laboratory, I'm actually collaborating with a local chamber orchestra and a singer here in Portland. And we're putting on a show about the neuroscience of motherhood. So there's been all this beautiful new data about how a woman's brain changes during pregnancy in really dramatic ways. But also how a woman and a child's brains together change with bonding over time, and how that keeps going generationally. So we're even looking at grandmothers and their relationships with their daughters and their grandchildren. And so it's a lot to talk about from the standpoint of music. There's great music out there about motherhood and mothers and children. There's great poetry that we're going to include in this production. And there's some really interesting neuroscience. And so that's my big new project.
I'm outside of the lab. Looking forward to hearing more about it, actually. It sounds very interesting. Well, Larry and Dennis, thank you very much for joining me today. It was a great discussion.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
It was fun, yeah.